tonight on Arena. Saoirse Ronan, Steve McQueen and Stephen Graham talk to us about Blitz, McQueen's new movie about wartime London, and Ali Smith on her new novel, Glyph. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And nice to be back in the seat after a week of spooks and ghouls. And thanks to Care for looking after things last week. The artist and Oscar-winning filmmaker Steve McQueen's new feature, Blitz, opens in Irish cinemas this weekend. And while the setting of wartime London is a much-visited well of inspiration for filmmakers, McQueen finds a fresh way to tell this story. The focus is on George, mixed-race boy, furious at his mother, played by Saoirse Ronan, after she takes the decision for him to be evacuated from the city, as thousands of children were, of course, at the time. George, who is played wonderfully, I have to say, by newcomer Elliot Heffernan, jumps off the evacuation train and makes his way back to London. What follows then is an odyssey of sorts. George uses his guile and wit to navigate the war-torn city and to deal with the characters he meets, not all of them with his best interests at heart. As well as Saoirse and Elliot, the film stars Harris Dickinson, Stephen Graham, Kathy Burke and musician Paul Weller as Rita's father. That's the character played by Saoirse. The father is called Gerald. I recently spoke to the writer-director Steve McQueen and actor Stephen Graham, who plays Albert, a petty criminal who takes advantage of George as he tries to find his way home. But before I bring you those conversations, let's hear from Saoirse Ronan and Elliot Heffernan, who play mother and son, Rita and George. In this scene from the film, George is trying to talk her out of sending him away.
Why can't you come with me?
Sweetheart, I told you it's an adventure for children only. Grown-ups not allowed. But it's going to be great. You're going to make new friends.
My friends already are.
Yeah, well, you play games in the countryside. That'd be nice. There'll be cows and there'll be horses.
But they smell. I want to stay with you.
Yeah, I know. It's only until all this is over. And then the schools will open again and life will get back to normal, I promise.
Please, Mum, don't send me away.
Saoirse Ronan, Elliot Heffernan, playing Rita and George Marcus, mother and son in Steve McQueen's Blitz. You're both very welcome to Arena. Mother and son on screen. I'll come to you first in this one, Saoirse. How did you go about creating that wonderful family chemistry that is there between the two of you as we watch the film?
I think we were really lucky that it just happened very naturally. You know, we met a few weeks before we actually started to film together. And I think the fact that I was very young when I started as well, there was a lot that I could relate to when it came to what was expected of Elliot, and the fact that he was, you know, carrying so much on his shoulders and he did it so brilliantly. And yeah, we were just really lucky that we got on straight away. We had loads of fun, and I think that was our main focus, was to just have a laugh together, really.
Tell me a little bit, Elliot, about the character of George. Obviously, the scenes with Saoirse are all about mother and son, but you have so much to do outside of that. I'm thinking in particular of where you have to climb up onto the top of the train, or I'm thinking about the scene in the underground where the water is flooding down and you have to be the action hero and hopefully save people in that situation. Talk to me about that water scene in particular. How difficult was it just to act while being safe in the water, apart from anything else?
So I did have a lot of training for the scene. So after I had my training and I got on the set, I knew what to do, but I didn't really find it difficult because I really enjoyed being in the water and being pushed around by jets, being blown away by water and being drowned. I really enjoyed that. And I mean, I did have to act, but not as much because you're not really focusing on acting. Like, you're focused on...
Yeah, you don't really have to think about it because it's really happening.
Yeah. He was very brave.
Absolutely. I was going to ask you, Saoirse, would you have chanced that at Elliot's age yourself?
You know what we were saying yesterday, that I've done a lot of like water sequences and things like that, but only recently have I had to do a scene underwater in a tank, and I used the air mask in order to go really deep down.
Was this for the outrun, was it, or was it for something
else? The outrun, yeah, for the opening sequence. And I hated it. And I found it really hard to stay calm. And then I went on to Blitz and I came in one day and all the hair and makeup girls were like, yeah, he was just under there for like 10 minutes and he was really calm and cool. And I was like, cool, cool. That's not what I was like at all. So I think he's much more suited to it than I am.
Although I do remember, now you were a little bit older at this time, but in Hannah, you had a lot of action sequences in that, didn't you?
Yeah, but I think you're right. I think it's really fun, and something about doing action-packed scenes means that you're very present. Mm. You're not really thinking about what you're doing because everything's so physical, and he has to do so much of that in this movie. And yeah, it's just really impressive to see what he's done.
But finding the character of George Eliot, getting into his head and thinking yourself, imagining yourself into that time in history during the Blitz in the world, in World War II, how difficult was that?
It wasn't easy, but it wasn't like very hard. And that was all because of my acting coach, Simon. He really helped me and he taught me some cool things that I never heard of before.
Yeah, tell me some of those things that Simon would have helped you. How did he help you get into the emotion of some of those scenes?
He talked about this thing, he never stopped talking about it. It was intentions. And it's just when you're acting, you think about what your character really wants. And then there's the stakes and then how much the character wants it. And then you just apply those, then
just do it.
Yeah, you just do it.
I have to say, it sounds as if George could be, or Eliot rather, could be a little acting coach himself, the way he's put that forward.
Eliot's an actor through and through.
He's just there.
He's already a lead actor. It's amazing.
Well, he has the lead one. You could argue that's the lead role in the film because it very much is from the child's perspective. You, in terms of yourself, obviously, Saoirse, getting into the Blitz mentality maybe in Ireland wouldn't be as prevalent as, you know, in Irish school teaching, for example, in the history that we learned. How did you put yourself into that situation?
I mean, we were definitely exposed to lots of reading material and footage from the time period before we started. And, you know, I did the relevant research in that way. And it was great to be armed with that. I think what I found most helpful was watching video footage of young women around my age from the working classes in the UK in particular, and sort of the poise that they held themselves with and the manner in which they spoke. And, you know, it was a real insight into, it was the same in Dublin. It's like, you know, working class Dubs in particular will sort of, they will make so much of an effort when it comes to their appearance or how they want to come across, because they have to in a way that the higher classes just didn't. And that wasn't any different in the UK. So it was really lovely to see young women from that time and actually see how much you could relate to them. But really, I think my job was to, you know, protect this relationship that the two of us had, because the whole time that he's away, when we're separate from one another, all I'm doing is thinking of him and pining for that. And so it was really, I think we were very lucky that we established something very strong between the two of us that I could then play off of when he wasn't there.
Saoirse, how nerve-wracking was the music aspect of this? Wonderful that you had Paul Weller as your dad and on set. That family dynamic between the three of you, in fact, is lovely in that regard. But you have to sing a very big number in this.
Yeah, we had multiple songs originally in the film. So there was about five of them that I had kind of drilled for, I don't know, 2-3 months before we actually started the film. And I was doing vocal lessons with this incredible vocal coach, Fiona McDougall, who works with Andrew Lloyd Webber, actually.
There you go.
She's amazing. And that was sort of my way into the character, because we didn't really do, or I didn't do a lot of rehearsals with Elliot, and I don't think any of the cast did really. This was my way to sort of become focused, I suppose, on the project. And it was really nerve-wracking with some of those scenes, especially with something like Winter Coat, which was very much like a big performance. But then we had other really beautiful moments where myself and Elliot and Paul could just sort of mess about at the piano and sing a little bit and then come out of it again. And it always felt very kind of organic and playful, which was nice. But yeah, I was really nervous.
Turn up my collar, whatever the weather, you'll be with me. Wherever I go, we'll be together, just you and me. I wrap myself in a warm, sunny you, not to feel blue. My winter coat is you. Turn up my collar, whatever.
Stephen Graham, who plays the character of Albert in Steve McQueen's Blitz. You're very welcome to Arena, Steve. Stephen, I have to say, when I look at Albert, think of the Blitz, you think of heroes, you think of heroic actions, you think of people who do great things. Albert doesn't seem to fit into that category, does he?
No, he doesn't. And that was one of the key things that we tried to achieve with Albert, you know what I mean, straight away. That kind of, look, he's very much kind of, you can perceive it as, you know, like a Fagin-esque character, if you will, maybe to an extent. But also what we wanted to do, you know, me and Steve from the get-go, our idea instantly was to make him fully rounded and three-dimensional and as realistic as possible. You know, he's perceived as the slight villain for that moment in the story, but he's also a man who fought in the First World War, who is suffering from PTSD, who has to survive on a daily basis. Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of when you see the actions of what he does, and again, we did a lot of research and we looked at criminality during the Blitz, and if you look at it. You know, if you think about it as well, there was a lot of thievery and, you know, there were a lot of opportunists striking at the time. So he kind of comes from that school and that world. And it's kind of through the eyes of little George, we see this narrative and we see this film play out. And it's kind of, to me, he's like Pinocchio trying to get back to Geppetto. You know what I mean? And all of these characters he meets on the way. So in that respect, then, you know, Albert is the wolf, and that kind of the dangers of humanity and the brutality that humans can bring upon each other, but also the brutality that's been done to them as well.
And you mentioned there that, you know, he fought in the First World War. Was that part of an imagined scenario that you and Steve McQueen came up with for him? Because the Café de Paris event, which is central and a really grim scene within the film, where you have Kathy Burke playing your sister Beryl.
A wonderful Kathy Burke, yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about that scene, which has a basis in reality, certainly the events of March 1941 in that cafe.
Yes, but I see, and my thing is as well, you have both opposite ends of the spectrum within that, because initially we see the high society and the high echelons of society drinking champagne, eating foie gras, smoking ciggies, and dancing to like beautiful music as there's a war going on outside there. Do you know what I mean? So that's grotesque in many ways, and that's vulgar hugely. Do you know what I mean? But they're oblivious to it all, and it's happening, and it's beautiful, and it looks amazing, and you know, it's so full of life and vibrant. And then the next minute, poof, the bomb goes off. And each and every one of them, when you come back to them through our character's eyes, are dead. And then it's a case of, in order for us to survive, this is rich pickings. So we're taking earrings and watches and cigarette cases and pearl necklaces, and we're stealing these off these dead bodies. So, you know, the paradox of that is we're just as, what we're doing is grotesque and evil. But in the same respect, surely what they were doing 20 minutes.
Yeah. One final question. One final question, Stephen. Here you are in this film, as you have done before. I'm thinking particularly about The Irishman, where you have this pivotal scene in quite a large film. What did Steve McQueen do in terms of going through the character with you and on set that made it possible for you to come into this big machine and have such an important role within that pivotal few scenes?
When we discussed it, you know, look, Stanislavski, it is that said, there's no small parts, only small actors, no small roles, only small actors. So, we knew it was integral to the story. And I just wanted to bring as much realism and gravity to that role as we could. And the fact that it was me and Kathy Burke as well as the rest of the crew, you know, for me, that was a huge honour. So it was a case of then just playing it as truthfully and as authentically and as honestly as possible. It was an honour for Steve to ask me to play that role, do you know what I mean? So we wanted to bring as much gravity to it as possible and just make it as real as we possibly could, if I'm honest with you.
Well, you certainly did that. Stephen, thanks so much for speaking with us on Arena.
Cheers, mate. Thanks very much.
Here. Your dad would want you to have it.
How do you know?
I know because that's the kind of man he was. Because you're his son. And it belongs to you now. And it's going to keep you safe, all right? Put your shirt on and put your jacket on. Come downstairs, yeah?
Steve McQueen, director of Blitz. Thank you for being with us on Arena this evening, Steve. This whole story for you, Steve, has been in your head quite a while, and it all started with a single photograph. Describe that photograph to me and where you found it.
Well, it goes a little bit further back when I was the war artist in 2003, and I was posted off to Basra, and being with the troops there was kind of weird because, of course, being in the war zone as a civilian, but, you know, never happens. You know, again, it's really strange how one receives the war. Often on this side of the world is through the news, through the media, through you guys. And therefore, I was there on the ground, sort of seeing what was going on. And at that moment, I thought it'd be interesting to do something about the Blitz at that moment. Fast forward many years later, I was doing research on this film anthology, Small Acts, and I came across this photograph of a child, on a black child on a railway station, this boy with a large overcoat and an even larger suitcase with a cap on, waiting to be evacuated. And as soon as I saw that image, I thought, that's my in, to see the war through his eyes.
And looking at the war, looking at the Blitz through the eyes, that child's perspective, what did it give you?
Well, what it gave me was a starting point. It gave me, for me at least, a blank sheet of paper where I could redial the viewer, the audience's eyes onto the war in through a child's eyes. So basically, you redial in a way. You see things through his eyes. So with all the sort of, how can I say, all the sort of armor we put on ourselves, all the sort of, the sort of filters we put on ourselves, I want to remove those for us to see what things are rather than somehow how we've become desensitized to them.
And we see him heading off. He's leaving his family, but he doesn't want that. He makes his way back to London. So he brings us effectively around London as it is being blitzed. One of the most interesting characters that he met for me was the character played by Benjamin Clementine, this night watchman, this air raid warden. This character has a basis in reality, I believe.
Yes, he's based on he's based on a real person called, it was then called Ite Epion. He was an air warden who patrolled the Malibone area. And he was based on his and his experience. And there's a speech that he gives in an air raid shelter, which is kind of interesting that we use it in the film about how people were sort of, you know, dividing the area away from certain other people. Yeah.
And he compares that type of, he says, that's what Hitler is doing in this war. So let's not do it at home. The other real character within this is a character called Mickey Davies. Extraordinary man.
Yes. I mean, again, he was one of the sort of architects of the National Health Service who, you know, was a small gentleman who basically, he ran an LA shelter. He basically ran one. And I remember in our research, there was an American journalist who came to the air raid shelter and said, this is the first time he's ever seen democracy actually work in effect. It was the first pure, you know, example of democracy. So he was amazing. It's a hero, which unfortunately people didn't know. And, you know, again, this is not about ticking boxes as far as this person or this person. It was about the landscape, the odyssey that George goes on. And through that landscape, he comes across certain people doing certain things.
Yeah, and that aspect that you say, seeing it through George's eye. George is a child of a biracial child. His father was black. His mother, played by Saoirse Ronan, is a white woman. We have the character of Benjamin Clementine. We have Mickey Davies in there. We are seeing the Blitz from a viewpoint we don't normally see it. We normally see the white English view of the war. How important was it for you to show us it through these diverse eyes and in fact make us aware of that diversity?
Well, it wasn't important to me at all, really. Quite the opposite. It was just the things I found. When you research and you find things and you sort of, again, it's not about, as my son would say, flexing. It was a case of finding. And, you know, with my a historical advisor, Joshua Levine, who wrote The Secret History of the Blitz, you know, as Joshua would say, you know, the central of London was quite cosmopolitan. You know, things were going on there. It was just one of those things where when you go through that particular town, that particular area, things would arise. It was a very large Chinese community in London at that time, as well as a black community and the Asian community. So there were things going on there. You know, which maybe hasn't been portrayed in movies, but again, it's like cowboys and Indians, and then you find out that Native Americans aren't the bad guys.
Also, the wonderful Café de Paris scene, hugely important within the play as well. How eerie a scene did you want to create within that moment when that place is bombed and we just go in and we see these bodies sitting there?
Listen, there is a cause and effect with war. And there's no way of not showing the sort of, death, obviously, and the destruction. And again, obviously, through Charles' eyes, what is death? What is mortality through Charles' eyes? And he you know, Elliot, the actor George is confronted with that. Because again, you know, and we know as children that the thought of death is never in our head. And when, as a child, you're confronted with that, it's very sobering.
Can't talk about the film without talking about the magical casting of Paul Weller as the grandfather in this. What he brings as an actor, but also as a musician, because music is central to what you're doing, I think.
Yeah. Well, Paul, you know, again, I think Paul was not particularly, at the beginning when I asked him, he was not an enthusiast. He didn't need to, me act, but, thank goodness he relented, and I think he's extraordinary. And the depth, I mean, again, Paul, listen, when you could write and perform your songs, you should be able to act, because there's authenticity to Paul. Paul is not going to do anything where, there's not a sort of a reason to do it. And I was grateful that he could do it. But also, as far as music is concerned, music is our refuge as humans. It's our refuge. It's where we go to lull ourselves, to corral ourselves. To lull ourselves, through hard times and good. It's what we lean on. And I wanted to perfume the air with music in this picture, because that's what people did. That was their go-to.
Steve McQueen, thank you so much for being with us this evening on Arena.
So much for having me, sir.
Steve McQueen, writer and director of Blitz, which opens in Irish cinemas this weekend. It will be streamed on Apple TV Plus from November the 22nd. We'll be reviewing the film on Thursday night's Arena. Scottish writer Ali Smith has spoken to the programme on a number of occasions about her seasonal quartet of books for standalone yet interconnected novels. Her latest book, Glyph, she turns her attention to a nightmarish near future where climate change and runaway technical advances have destroyed society, created a miserable underclass. Maybe not that far-fetched a scenario, I'm thinking, as I'm delighted to welcome Ali Smith to the programme once again. And I was thinking about the seasonal quartet, Ali, the fact that those books were very much for me, and I think for you as a writer, you were writing almost in the present tense about what was happening around you, and you were publishing them so quickly. Here we are then with Glyph, which on the surface seems like a dystopian novel, a futuristic novel. But when I think about the state of technology in Glyph, I think maybe this is actually as much a present tense and present moment novel as, in fact, the Seasonal Quartet were.
Thank you for having me back on the programme, and it's nice to hear you again and to be speaking with you. I have this theory in it that there is no such thing as a futuristic novel, and there's no such thing really as a historical novel, because whatever it is that you're writing about, the pores of the skin of the book will be emitting the times that the book has been written in. In this dystopian kind of glance of a novel, there's nothing except for one central, very creaky, you might say, image, very creaky device that isn't actually already happening to someone somewhere in the world. There's nothing in this novel that hasn't already been happening to folk for a few years, and down the line, somewhere in our planet, these things are happening to folk.
Yeah,
you know, you could say it's dystopian, but you could say we're living in the most dystopian times that I've ever seen.
that's for sure. And I suppose, if we, without getting too philosophical about it, the novel only exists at the moment it's read by the reader. It completes some kind of existence in that present moment, a bit like the tree falling. Did it fall if we didn't hear it? But let's not go down that route, or we'll be in a rabbit hole for the entire chat. The one thing that really is so up to the minute and so present in the novel, Ali, is technology, smartwatches, how we are watching them and they are watching us, and all kinds of technological devices that are watching us just as much as we're looking at them.
Yep, we are. They are. Everything about us is now being tracked one way or another by whatever a system of surveillance thinks it can make of us and with us. And the problem with that is that we are more than surveillance, and we are more than data, and we are much more than algorithm, and we are human beings. And the way that things are going at the moment, the pressure on us to deliver data without even knowing we're delivering data, it's just something that we have to start being aware of. I mean, we're pretty aware of it, and we're accepting it, and we're going with it. You know, I'm always remembering a conversation I had with Margaret Atwood, who is the great dystopian present time writer of our times. I said to her, what can we do if technology turns against us, or technology uses us without our choice of it using us? And she shrugged her shoulders and said, well, the thing about every advance we make is that human beings tend to use it badly at first and then decide that they'll use it better afterwards. She's got a very long view, Atwood, which I hold at the back of my head always, because you know, the questions that technology is asking of us right now is something that we're finding out in the world is a lot bigger than we are, and a lot bigger than just the data of one person is. It's become a kind of question of what happens to us as a mass.
Yeah, so even though you're clearly, the story that you're telling in this book shows some kind of fear and anxiety, which I think a lot of people would share with you, around the uses of technology and what technology is capable of doing, you still have that little bit of hope via Margaret Atwood that we'll be okay eventually.
Not just via Margaret Atwood, but because this is just a story about two kids and a horse. I mean, it is that basic. It's a folk tale, this book. And, you know, don't tell me that folk tales haven't told us about reality, you know, over all the centuries. But really, you know, it's about two kids who come face to face, probably for the first time in their lives, with the face of a horse and the existence of a horse. And what are they going to make of this other creature who's now in there? You know, and so it's fabular, the story, really. That is a hope. That's a hope, if Abel is ancient.
For sure, yeah. And it's going to teach us something that we will be better off learning rather than ignoring, I guess, in some ways. Tell us a little bit about Brian Rose and the horse, Glyph, but let's concentrate on Brian Rose and their sibling relationship, first of all.
Okay, well, yeah, they're these two kids. They're maybe 13 and 11, I think, roughly, maybe 12 and 14. They come up against an interesting conundrum, where their mother has had to go off and help a family member in another country who's ill and who's taking her place to work so she doesn't lose her job. And the kids are travelling about with their mum's partner, who's called Leif. And then they get home to their house and they find that someone has painted a red line, a red paint line round the circumference of their house, at which point Leif loads them back into the camper van and just drives away. And then as the story progresses, these two young people, resourceful young people, because they have to become resourceful, find themselves living by themselves in an empty house and wondering how to survive.
They are what is called in this world that they live in, unverifiables. And unverifiables are not good things. When you're not verified, you can't get access to any of your devices, as we all know. But yeah. Unverifiables are, it's not a good place, potentially, to find yourself in this society.
There we go. What is it that verifies us as a human being is, I suppose, the core question at the back of the story. What is it that makes someone say you are not a human being to another human being? And so the idea of how you are verified, how you prove you're a human being is, I mean, when you put it in the mind of an 11-year-old girl, which Rose is, and she's like, well, you know, nothing's going to prove I'm me except me. Here I am. And she kind of produces herself. Here I am. So those larger questions about what it is that makes us rather than what it is that, you know, reduces us to information. The book is also about the balance, which is now skewing between information and knowledge and the physical self, the, you know, the existence, the human existence, and the ways in which we are delineated by a system that decides to make us less than ourselves, I suppose.
Yeah, and all we have to do to prove we're not a robot in the world of technology is spot where the motorcycles are in the picture or spot where the steps are in the picture. You know, we don't actually have to prove that we're human at all.
I know. Exactly. So that's funny because there's a very funny cartoon that's been doing the rounds. Have you seen it? Where there's a pupil comes in and says to Buddha, Buddha, what is it that proves we are human? And he says, ticking the boxes that say there is a motorcycle.
there
I mean, that's you know, it's not that's right.
No.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and the other side of it is sometimes it's hard to do that as a human being, know which ones are the
that's
right boxes
hard.
To tick. However, on a more serious note, within this society, one of the ways, I suppose, that we're looking at how things have broken down, communal activity is much less prevalent than I like it to be. And I think we have hopefully experienced in our lives up to this point in time. For example, children are not going to school anymore to learn. Education is kind of, it's old hat.
Isn't that amazing? The notion that the things which have been deep in the infrastructure for all the centuries that we've been lucky enough to have them deep in the infrastructure, like learning, like health, like a system which will look towards the progress of the person, and all those infrastructures, we've seen them shaking around us at the moment. So, I mean, the question of whether or not they'll hold and how we'll go forward into them is also at the back of this book.
Yeah, and at another point in the book, we see an old theatre being destroyed. And I'm guessing in some ways, It's a follow on from COVID, this, because during COVID, theatres, cinemas, everything was closed down. And who is it? I think it's Una, who's a kind of a wise woman that Brian and Rose meet along the way, a wise elder woman. She talks about, sure, what are those things for, theatre and cinemas, other than for people to go in, sit down together and enjoy something and together and talk about it afterwards.
Well, the screen world, I mean, here I am talking to you on a screen, as it were, although I can't see you, I can hear you, but the screen world has really changed things for us, because if you walk down the street now and you count the number of people who are looking at their screen rather than looking at their, you know, the road or saying hello to folk, I cycle about in this town I live in, and the number of people that I pass who can't, you know, hear me say sorry or thanks when I go past them, this is a very, very small detail, but it's something about the ways in which we have always communicated with each other in a nodding, glancing way is also has become questionable or is shifting in our own everyday passage down the street as a species.
Yeah, but it's like if I'm sure you have been here, if you come to Ireland, you say thank you to the bus driver as you get off, you know, which is still a thing in this country that I'm not sure is anywhere else. But I'm interested, you know, this idea.
We should always be saying thank you to the driver. Oh my goodness, we you know, and also, yeah, of course, I've been to Ireland. My mum was Irish. I don't know if we spoke about this the last time.
She's from Limavady, isn't she?
That's right. She was from Limavady. She's a good on you, Sean. So no, of course, I'm claiming my Irishness.
Ah, yeah. Why wouldn't you? But that communal aspect of things, it's obviously, am I right in thinking, it's a fear. It's something that you're observing at the moment. Is it getting worse and worse?
Sorry, I missed that last thing. What was that?
I'm just asking, is it getting worse as time progresses?
I don't know. If it's getting worse, then at some point it's going to get better, because we will do something about it and remember where we are with each other. But like I say, the the little screen that we carry in our pocket, which now gives us all our information and holds all our information and tells us where we are in the world, is just a little screen. And a screen, you know what a screen means? A screen means something between you and something else. It means that there's a divide. And so it's kind of no wonder that the world at the moment is so preoccupied with its own division.
That's a wonderful way of thinking of screen, which I haven't thought of until you just said it right now.
You know, at the doctor's to take your clothes off, you'd go behind a screen, or you'd go to the bank and there'd be a screen between you and the persons. Just to remember what the thing is that we're now all of us carrying in our pockets, like they're part of us, and they are part of us, and that's important. Now we have, you know, there's no point in railing at technology. We have to think how to use it. Technology is brilliant. The amazing advances that we have been making with the changes in how we understand how we know things and how we can gather knowledge is marvellous, but we have to remember to gather knowledge with it rather than to use it against ourselves.
When I picked up the book, I thought, well, I know the first question for Ali is going to be, what does glyph mean? And here I am, 12 minutes later, I think, or thereabouts, asking you, what does glyph mean? But you might explain that word. It's the name that the girls give to this horse that you mentioned that they meet as part of this, as you call it, a fabular, quite simple story at some levels. Is it a real word?
It is a real word, believe it or not. I was playing about on the internet, looking up the word glyph, glyph. I was interested in all the sort of ramifications of the word glyph, which means the mark that we make on anything. It basically means the smallest unit of meaning, which is not actually a word. And then I found this word glyff, and I thought, that's not a word. What's that mean? And I looked it up, and oh my goodness, it means about, I don't know, 50, 60 things. Those are just in a casual glance at what it means. This little word, which looks like it's meaningless, means so much. And then I was thinking, isn't that what language is like? The words we use, as soon as you start to pay attention to them, just the littlest bit of attention, then the words expand and expand and expand. They're multiplicitous. They're like we are, actually. As soon as, you know, or we pay ourselves or we pay others any attention, the story of us expands and expands and expands. And I think that's one of the gifts of language, which is something that looked meaningless. Is so full of meaning. So one of the characters in the book decides to call the horse Glyph because someone else has said, oh, be careful with that horse. It's a very glyphy horse. And she's like, what's glyphy? And then she thinks, well, glyph's a good word. A glyph in that sense, it's a good word for horses. It means a nervous horse, a horse that's a bit too nervy. You'll be a bit careful around the horse. But glyph, the word, it means everything from a glance, a moment, a fright, a shock, all the way to the thawing of snow or the fall of sunlight. That's a sudden, one of those sudden bursts of sunlight that then suddenly is there and then gone again. It's such it's a gorgeous word. And have you ever heard it before? Because I hadn't.
I had not. And when I heard the meaning, or read the meaning, I was astonished by the multiplicity of meanings held within it. And it's a theme that you explore within the story as well, Ali, because Brian Rose find themselves looking at dictionaries in a library. I think it is a library that they're looking at the dictionaries at one point along the way. And getting great fun, which I guess you probably have done and continue to do, looking up words and finding their various meanings. But it leads to this kind of thought around, what about the horse? The horse has no language. So are we above, below, on the same level? Where are we in that, if hierarchy is even a suitable word to use? But that is something you're looking at.
No, thank you, Sean, because that's exactly right. I think the core of this book is about how meaning works and how it doesn't, and what makes things meaningful and what makes things meaningless. And Bri, one of the siblings, spends their time going back and forth, going, well, what does this mean? And what is this word? A very word conscious person, where Rose is not that interested in meaning, except unless you can play with it. So she does a lot of playing about with words that Bri wouldn't do, because Bri wants to know the meaning of things. And so there's a question at the back of this about language itself. And of course, saying the horse has no language, well, no, the horse does have a language, but you have to learn the horse's language if you want to communicate with the horse, because otherwise, you know, words will only go so far with a horse. And then what does it mean that we think we can, you know, human beings think we can call things and that's what they are? And so the whole question of how we use the ways in which we are labelled, how we are used by the ways in which we are labelled, and how other species are also communicating all the time with us and on all sorts of language levels that on a surface level you might think don't exist because they're not words, but oh, they are their own kind of words. There's a whole, whole range of possibilities of language in there.
Yeah, just because we don't know the word and it's not made up of consonants and syllables or consonants and vowels, that doesn't mean the word doesn't exist in some other realm. One thing I do want to touch on, and I want to be careful how I touch on this because I don't want to, quite a spoiler, but something that I think you mightn't want to go too far down. The character of Bri at one stage along the way is asked, are you a boy or a girl? And Bri says, I am. It's a wonderful, it's a wonderful answer.
Good. Because there are points in our lives where everything is open. And there are points in our lives where everything sort of shifts and closes and kind of becomes fixed. And I've always thought that the shift between childhood, adolescence and adulthood is always about the question of what's fluidity, what's possible and what can hold against the kind of codes that come into our lives and tell us and express to us that there's pressure on us to settle on being one thing rather than two things rather than three things rather than four things. Actually, in the end, we are all full of that same multiplicity, that same history of multiplicity that every word, every single little word holds.
We're all a bit gliffy.
We're all a bit gliffy. It's certainly a gliffy old time in the world at the moment, but let's just bear in mind that gliff can also mean to thaw snow.
Yeah. We keep that in mind.
And sunlight.
Finally, sunlight. I did notice a bit of a gap in the middle of the novel, a skip of time. And yes, that's perfectly acceptable. I'm wondering, I have the feeling that there's more to come in this story of Brian Rose. Am I right?
I hope so. I can't tell you for sure. It's happening at the moment. Anyway, somewhere inside me, it's beginning to happen. So I've got another. This book was always supposed to be a kind of sibling book to another book called Glyph, Glyph. In other words, the word that looks meaningless and the word that is all about meaning, kind of balanced together in the two books. So you might say that there's a space or an open door in this novel, which, well, I'll find out where it's going shortly, but I can't tell you anything about it.
Absolutely.
Because otherwise, you know what? I'll look at it and I'll say it out loud and then I'll never be able to write it.
You'll never find the door again. You'll never be able to go in.
It'll just run away. It'll just be like that one of those foxes that lives quite close to our house that when you look at it goes, I'm off.
And now that you've called me Fox, I'm out of here.
Exactly.
Ali, brilliant to speak with you. Thanks so much for being with us on Arena.
Thanks, Son. It's such a pleasure to talk to you again. All the best.
All the best. That's Ali Smith, and Ali's new novel, Glyph, is published by Hamish Hamilton. Ninety years ago, a meeting took place in Hollywood that changed how films would be made for the next three decades. Studio heads came together to draw up a policy that would prohibit release of any film not approved by the newly set up Motion Picture Production Code. Approval was only given to films that avoided some subjects completely and treated other, quote, sensitive subjects in a very restrictive manner. It became known as the Hays Code after its first president, William Hays. Stephen Benedict is here to tell us a little bit more about that code. First of all, let's have a listen to Hays himself, speaking in 1934, explaining the codes of practice.
The code sets up high standards of performance for motion picture producers. It states the considerations which good taste and community value make necessary in this universal form of entertainment. Respect for law, respect for every religion, respect for every race, and respect for every nation. It keeps the motion picture free, too, to continue its amazing artistic development. 1,000 hands would like to burden pictures with propaganda. They shall not. Others would like to bring this great entertainment of yours under stifling and artificial domination. That you will not permit. You want entertainment, wholesome, interesting, and vital. This the motion picture industry is pledged to provide.
William Hays, reassuring, if that's the word, the American public in 1934, that he knew exactly what they should think and exactly what they should be watching and what it should entail. It's kind of an extraordinary speech, Stephen Benedict, when you listen to it now. I know, with all the benefit of 90 years behind us.
Yeah.
But it really was That was kind of dictatorship.
It was.
Has the whiff of that off it.
Yeah, and the reason why it came about was because in the 20s and early 30s, Hollywood had had experienced a series of high-profile scandals involving drugs and suicide and murder. And that drew unwanted attention from very, very strict conservative groups on the other side of America. And they viewed that Hollywood was nothing more than a den of iniquity. But to put it very, very bluntly, these very, very same religious groups were convinced that Hollywood is run by a group of Jewish immigrants whose films were part of this international cabal to overtake the world. The Protocols of Zion, that sort of nonsense. But the thing we've got to remember is that in the 1930s, the third biggest political party in the United States was the Ku Klux Klan. And so anti-Semitism was commonplace. And what happened was that the studios, which were run for the most part by Jewish immigrants, they were very, very concerned that the businesses and the companies they had built were going to be taken away from them. And the proof of that was in the US Constitution, because the US Supreme Court in 1915 had ruled that film did not fall under the First Amendment of freedom of speech. Literature did, film didn't. Right. And it meant that Washington could then dictate to Hollywood what they were going to make.
So obviously there was that immigrant aspect
of xenophobia.
To the argument, xenophobia within it and straightforward racism.
Yeah, anti-Semitism.
Within it as well. But what were the morals that they were so worried about? Dare I suggest that sex might have been involved?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is, we've got to remember, put it in context, before the Hays Code came in 1934, it wasn't as if all of Hollywood films was awash with nudity and profanity and sacrilege and violence. But what happened was that they came up with a set of values that they said, as you said, very tasteful. And one of the things that was happening before the Hays Code was that you would have relationships and romances between people of different ethnic groups. Suddenly that was prohibited.
Gone.
That was gone. Subject matter like abortion, drug abuse or prostitution was gone. Any hint of homosexuality was gone. I mean, we sound like these guys who are selling carpets. They're gone by Friday if they're not gone. You know, so this was what was happening when the Hays Code came in. So they were trying to whitewash that from the screen.
So I presume men should behave in a certain way, women should behave in a certain way, and your status within society would demand that you would behave subservient or superior, whichever the case may be, which is kind of touched on in Barbara Stanwyck in the film
Babyface,
where she's kind of told, your father's dead now, here's what you should do.
Yeah, the thing was, when the movie was originally released in 1933, the character was about Lily Powers, who from the age of 14 was prostituted out by her father in a brothel that he ran. And then when she's an adult, her father dies and the character of Lily is then played by Barbara Stanwyck. And then she's told that, she's given this speech by a character and then she goes off to New York to literally work her way up the corporate ladder. When the movie was then...
It was remade, wasn't it?
Well, what happened was it was withdrawn from circulation by Warner Brothers, then it was re-edited and re-released. And the moral bent of the film was very, very restrictive, very, very prohibitive and punishing her all the way through when the original version was much more sympathetic.
Now, then, of course, creative people being creative
had to find creative ways
around the Hays Code. How did they do that? Give us a good example.
They didn't invent, but they resorted to subtext, because subtext can never be proven. Because if the Hays Code says, well, that is not a cigar, is not just a cigar, they protest and say, well, we've no idea what you're talking about. And so prime examples of those would be two great films, one of them starring Barbara Stanwyck again from Double Indemnity in 1944. And that was a movie that faced great difficulty being made because it was about two adulterers who commit murder. And I think you may have a clip.
So it's Double Indemnity. Fred McMurray has come to the house to sell insurance. Barbara Stanwyck comes down the stairs giving him an eyeful, believe it or not, of her ankle. And he's totally smitten immediately, the way he would be.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head on your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it.
Yeah, we think we know that they're not quite talking about what they're talking about there. That's Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck in Billy Wilde's film Double Indemnity. And in fact, war movies in terms of the Hays Code, Stephen Benedict, they kind of pushed the limits, right? They pushed it right out to the very edge.
They did, because noir tackles subject matter that the Hays Code wanted to eradicate, which was essentially adultery and female sexuality. And it wasn't only prevalent in Double Indemnity. There's a cracking scene in The Big Sleep, which is adapted from Raymond Chandler's novel, which is all about a ring of pornographers. But the Hays Code prohibited that sort of content. Literature was able to do it, but films couldn't. And as a consequence, they couldn't express what the plot was about. And as a consequence, what they did was they created this fantastic repartee and banter between Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, where all they do is riff on these great subtexts. The plot is incomprehensible as a result.
Yeah, and then at one stage they're talking about horse racing and who's in the saddle, and we all know what they're talking about.
We don't, because that's the subtext and you can never prove it.
I think we have a good idea. And I'm also thinking of the great, it's not in The Big Sleep, what is the film that Lauren Bacall says, you know how to whistle, don't you?
That's To Have and Have Not, with the adapted from Ernest Hemingway's novel. Again, and that was the first introduction for Lauren Bacall meeting Humphrey Bogart, and the chemistry between them was so strong that they actually had to tone down the film because of the Hays Code.
Yeah, but that line itself, you know, you know how to whistle, don't you? Just put your lips together and blow again.
Yeah,
I'm sure. She's only talking about whistling. There may be other things as well. So, how long did it last, and when did they say, to heck with this?
It lasted until the mid 1960s, till 1966, when it was replaced by a voluntary code. The first one was compulsory. But the thing that I find curious, Sean, is that once the Hays Code is replaced, a slew of filmmakers rushed in, and the very, very first thing that they did was they started stripping women on screen until they were naked and then having them assaulted on camera. And you say to yourself, what was it in the mind of filmmakers that they think this is artistic expression or freedom of expression?
So it was like the first thing, it was a swing too far in the opposite direction.
That's correct. Surely the Hays Code was actually very, very prohibitive. It prevented the cultural expression of film in America at the time. And once it was replaced, what was it replaced by? These guys just making these very, very puerile films.
All right. Food for thought, for sure. That is Stephen Benedict telling us about the Hays Code, 90 years old this year. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Niall McMonagall was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Paulie McNamara. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.